And I will now, as an humble and a loyal corporate servant, ask you for one small favor, said Fern. If the letter seems to cast the vaguest light on what life might be about, I would appreciate your telephoning me at home. Ransom K. Fern saluted by touching the shaft of his cane to his Homburg hat. Goodbye, Mr. Magnum Opus Jr. Goodbye. The Wilburhampton Hotel was a frumpish three-story Tudor structure across the street from the Magnum Opus building, standing in relation to that building like an unmade bed at the feet of the Archangel Gabriel. Pine slats were tacked to the stucco exterior of the hotel, simulating half-timbered construction. The backbone of the roof had been broken intentionally, simulating great age. The eaves were plump and low, tucked under, simulating thatch. The windows were tiny, with diamond-shaped panes. The hotel's small cocktail lounge was known as the Hear Ye Room. In the Hear Ye Room were three people, a bartender and two customers. The two customers were a thin woman and a fat man, both seemingly old. Nobody in the Wilburhampton had ever seen them before, but it already seemed as though they had been sitting in the Hear Ye Room for years. Their protective coloration was perfect, for they looked half-timbered and broken-backed and thatched and little-windowed, too. They claimed to be pensioned-off teachers from the same high school in the Middle West. The fat man introduced himself as George M. Hemholtz, a former bandmaster. The thin woman introduced herself as Roberta Wiley, a former teacher of algebra. They had obviously discovered the consolations of alcohol and cynicism late in life. They never ordered the same drink twice. They were avid to know what was in this bottle and what was in that one, to know what a Golden Dawn Punch was, and a Helen 12 Trees, and a Puy d'Or, and a Merry Widow Fizz. The bartender knew they weren't alcoholics. He was familiar with the type, and loved the type. They were simply two Saturday Evening Post characters at the end of the road. When they weren't asking questions about the different things to drink, they were indistinguishable from millions of other American barflies on the first day of the new age of space. They sat solidly on their bar stools, staring straight ahead at the ranks of bottles. Their lips moved constantly, experimenting dismayingly with irrelevant grins and grimaces and sneers. Evangelist Bobby Denton's image of Earth as God's spaceship was an apt one, particularly with reference to barflies. Hemholtz and Miss Wiley were behaving like pilot and co-pilot of an enormously pointless voyage through space that was expected to take forever. It was easy to believe that they had begun the voyage nattily flushed with youth and technical training, and that the bottles before them were the instruments they had been watching for years and years and years. It was easy to believe that each day had found the space boy and the space girl microscopically more slovenly than the day before, until now, when they were the shame of the Pan-Galactic Space Service. Two buttons on Hemholtz's fly were open. There was shaving cream in his left ear. His socks did not match. Miss Wiley was a crazy-looking little old lady with a lantern jaw. She wore a frizzy black wig that looked as though it had been nailed to a farmer's barn door for years.
"I see where the president has ordered a whole brand new age of space to begin, to see if that won't help the unemployment picture some," said the bartender.
"Uh-huh," said Hemholtz and Miss Wiley simultaneously. Only an observant and suspicious person would have noticed a false note in the behavior of the two. Hemholtz and Miss Wiley were too interested in time. For people who had nothing much to do and nowhere much to go, they were extraordinarily interested in their watches. Miss Wiley in her mannish wristwatch, Mr. Hemholtz in his gold pocket watch. The truth of the matter was that Hemholtz and Miss Wiley weren't retired school teachers at all.
They were both males, both masters of disguise. They were crack agents for the Army of Mars, the eyes and ears for a Martian press gang that hovered in a flying saucer 200 miles overhead. Malachi Constant didn't know it, but they were waiting for him. Hemholtz and Wiley did not accost Malachi Constant when he crossed the street to the Wilburhampton. They gave no sign that he mattered to them. They let him cross the lobby and board the elevator without giving him a glance. They did, however, glance at their watches again, and an observant and suspicious person would have noticed that Miss Wiley pressed a button on her watch, starting a stopwatch hand on its twitching rounds. Hemholtz and Miss Wiley were not about to use violence on Malachi Constant. They had never used violence on anyone, and had still recruited 14,000 persons for Mars. Their usual technique was to dress like civil engineers and offer not-quite-bright men and women $9 an hour, tax-free, plus food and shelter and transportation, to work on a secret government project in a remote part of the world for 3 years. It was a joke between Hemholtz and Miss Wiley that they had never specified what government was organizing the project, and that no recruit had ever thought to ask. 99% of the recruits were given amnesia upon arriving on Mars. Their memories were cleaned out by mental health experts, and Martian surgeons installed radio antennas in their skulls in order that the recruits might be radio-controlled. And then the recruits were given new names in the most haphazard fashion, and were assigned to the factories, the construction gangs, the administrative staff, or to the Army of Mars. The few recruits who were not treated in this way were those who demonstrated ardently that they would serve Mars heroically without being doctored at all. Those lucky few were welcomed into the secret circle of those in command. Secret agents Hemholtz and Wiley belonged to this circle. They were in full possession of their memories, and they were not radio-controlled. They adored their work, just as they were.
"What's that there Slivovitz like?"
Hemholtz asked the bartender, squinting at a dusty bottle on the bottom row. He had just finished a slow gin ricky.
"I didn't even know we had it," said the bartender.
He put the bottle on the bar, tilting it away from himself so he could read the label.
"Prune brandy," he said.
"I'll believe I'll try that next," said Hemholtz.
Ever since the death of Noel Constant, room 223 in the Wilburhampton had been left empty, as a memorial. Malachi Constant now let himself into room 223. He had not been in the room since the death of his father. He closed the door behind him and found the letter under the pillow. Nothing in the room had been changed but the linen. The picture of Malachi as a little boy on the beach was still the only picture on the wall. The letter said, "Dear son, something big and bad has happened to you, or you wouldn't be reading this letter. I am writing this letter to tell you to calm down about the bad things and kind of look around and see if something good, or something important anyway, happened on account of we got so rich, then lost the boodle again. What I want you to try and find out is there anything special going on, or is it all just as crazy as it looked to me? If I wasn't a very good father, or a very good anything, that was because I was as good as dead for a long time before I died. Nobody loved me, and I wasn't very good at anything, and I couldn't find any hobbies I liked, and I was sick and tired of selling pots and pans and watching television. So, I was as good as dead, and I was too far gone to ever come back. That is when I started the business with the Bible, and you know what happened after that. It looked as though somebody or something wanted me to own the whole planet, even though I was as good as dead. I kept my eyes open for some kind of signal that would tell me what it was all about, but there wasn't any signal. I just went on getting richer and richer. And then your mother sent me that picture of you on the beach, and the way you looked at me out of that picture made me think maybe you were what all the big money was built up for. I decided I would die without ever seeing any sense to it,
and maybe you would be the one who would all of a sudden see everything clear as a bell. I tell you, even a half-dead man hates to be alive and not be able to see any sense to it. The reason I told Ransom K. Fern to give you this letter, only if your luck turned bad, is that nobody thinks or notices anything as long as his luck is good. Why should he? So have a look around for me, boy. And if you go broke and somebody comes along with a crazy proposition, my advice is to take it. You might just learn something when you're in a mood to learn something. The only thing I ever learned was that some people are lucky and other people aren't. And not even a graduate of the Harvard Business School can say why. Yours truly, your Pa. There was a knock on the door of room 223. The door opened before Constant could reply to the knock. Helmholtz and Miss Wiley let themselves in. They entered at precisely the right instant, having been advised by the superiors as to when, to the second, Malachi Constant would finish the letter. They had been told, too, precisely what to say to him. Miss Wiley removed her wig, revealing herself to be a scrawny man, and Helmholtz composed his features to reveal that he was fearless and used to command.
"Mr. Constant," said Helmholtz, "I am here to inform you that the planet Mars is not only populated, but populated by a large and efficient and military and industrial society. It has been recruited from Earth, with the recruits being transferred to Mars by flying saucer. We are now prepared to offer you a direct lieutenant colonelcy in the Army of Mars. Your situation on Earth is hopeless. Your wife is a beast. Moreover, our intelligence informs us that here on Earth, you will not only be made penniless by civil suits, but that you will be in prison for criminal negligence as well. In addition to a pay scale and privileges well above those accorded lieutenant colonels in Earthling armies, we can afford you immunity from all Earthling legal harassment, and an opportunity to see a new and interesting planet. And an opportunity to think about your native planet from a fresh and beautifully detached viewpoint."
"If you accept the commission," said Miss Wiley, "raise your left hand and repeat after me." On the following day, Malachi Constant's helicopter was found empty in the middle of the Mojave Desert. The footprints of a man led away from it for a distance of 40 feet, then stopped. It was as though Malachi Constant had walked 40 feet and had then dissolved into thin air. On the following Tuesday, the spaceship known as the Whale was rechristened the Rumford and was readied for firing. Beatrice Rumford smugly watched the ceremonies on a television set 2,000 miles away. She was still in Newport. The Rumford was going to be fired in exactly 1 minute. If Destiny was going to get Beatrice Rumford on board, it was going to have to do it in one hell of a hurry. Beatrice was feeling marvelous. She had proved so many good things. She had proved that she was mistress of her own fate, could say no whenever she pleased, and make it stick. She had proved that her husband's omniscient bullying was all a bluff, that he wasn't much better at forecasts than the United States Weather Bureau. She had, moreover, worked out a plan that would enable her to live in modest comfort for the rest of her days, and would, at the same time, give her husband the treatment he deserved. The next time he materialized, he would find the estate teeming with gawkers. Beatrice was going to charge them $5 a head to come in through the Alice in Wonderland door. This was no pipe dream. She had discussed it with 2 supposed representatives of the mortgage holders on the estate, and they were enthusiastic. They were with her now, watching the preparations for the firing of the Rumford on television. The television set was in the same room with the huge painting of Beatrice as an immaculate little girl in white, with a white pony all her own. Beatrice smiled up at the painting. The little girl had yet to get the least bit soiled. The television announcer now began the last minute's countdown for the firing of the Rumford. During the countdown, Beatrice's mood was bird-like. She could not sit still and could not keep quiet. Her restlessness was a result of happiness not of suspense. It was a matter of indifference to her whether the Rumford was a fizzle or not. Her two visitors, on the other hand, seemed to take the firing very seriously, seemed to be praying for the success of the shot. They were a man and a woman, Mr. George M. Hemholtz and his secretary, Miss Roberta Wiley. Miss Wiley was a funny-looking little old thing, but very alert and witty. The rocket went up with a roar. It was a flawless shot. Hemholtz sat back and heaved a manly sigh of relief. Then he smiled and beat his thick thighs exuberantly.
"By glory," he said, "I'm proud to be an American, and proud to be living in the time I do."
"Would you like something to drink?" said Beatrice.
"Thank you very much," said Hemholtz. "But I daren't mix business with pleasure."
"Isn't the business all over?" said Beatrice. "Haven't we discussed everything?"
"Well, Miss Wiley and I had hoped to take an inventory of the larger buildings on the ground," said Hemholtz. "But I'm afraid it's gotten quite dark. Are there floodlights?"
Beatrice shook her head.
"Sorry," she said.
"Perhaps you have a powerful flashlight," said Hemholtz.
"I can probably get you a flashlight," said Beatrice. "But I don't think it's really necessary for you to go out there. I can tell you what all the buildings are."
She rang for the butler, told him to bring a flashlight.
"There's the tennis house, the greenhouse, the gardener's cottage, what used to be the gatehouse, the carriage house, the guest house, the tool shed, the bathhouse, the kennel, and the old water tower."
"Which one is the new one?"
said Hemholtz.
"The new one?" said Beatrice.
The butler returned with a flashlight, which Beatrice gave to Hemholtz.
"The metal one," said Miss Wiley. "Metal?" said Beatrice, puzzled. "There aren't any metal buildings. Maybe some of the weathered shingles have kind of a silvery look," she frowned. "Did somebody tell you there was a metal building here?"
"We saw it when we came in," said Hemholtz.
"Right by the path, in the undergrowth near the fountain," said Miss Wiley.
"I can't imagine," said Beatrice.
"Could we go out and have a look?" said Hemholtz.
"Yes, of course," said Beatrice, rising.
The party of three crossed the Zodiac on the foyer floor, moved into the balmy dark. The flashlight beam danced before them.
"Really," said Beatrice, "I'm as curious to find out what it is as you are. It looks like some kind of prefabricated thing made out of aluminum," said Miss Wiley.
"It looks like a mushroom-shaped water tank or something," said Hemholtz. "Only it's squatting right on the ground."
"Really?" said Beatrice. "You know what I said it was, don't you?" said Miss Wiley.
"No,"
said Beatrice. "What did you say it was?" "I have to whisper," said Miss Wiley playfully, "or somebody will want to lock me up in the crazy house."
She put her hand to her mouth, directing her loud whisper to Beatrice.
"Flying saucer," she said.
Chapter 4. Tent Rentals. Rented a tent, a tent, a tent, rented a tent, a tent, a tent, rented a tent, rented a tent, rented a tent. Snare drum on Mars. The men had marched to the parade ground to the sound of a snare drum. The snare drum had this to say to them. Rented a tent, a tent, a tent, rented a tent, a tent, a tent, rented a tent, rented a tent, rented a tent. They were an infantry division of 10,000 men, formed in a hollow square on a natural parade ground of solid iron 1 mile thick. The soldiers stood at attention on orange rust. They shivered rigidly, being as much like iron as they could be, both officers and men. Their uniforms were a rough-textured, frosty green, the color of lichens. The army had come to attention in utter silence. No audible or visible signal had been given. They had come to attention as a man, as though through a stupendous coincidence. The third man in the second squad of the 1st Platoon of the 2nd Company of the 3rd Battalion of the 2nd Regiment of the 1st Martian Assault Infantry Division was a private who had been broken from Lieutenant Colonel 3 years before. He had been on Mars for 8 years. When a man in a modern army is broken from field grade to private, it is likely that he will be old for a private, and that his comrades in arms, once they get used to the fact that he isn't an officer anymore, will, out of respect for his failing legs, eyes, and wind, call him something like Pops, or Gramps, or Unc. The third man in the second squad of the 1st Platoon of the 2nd Company in the 3rd Battalion of the 2nd Regiment of the 1st Martian Assault Infantry Division was called Unc. Unc was 40 years old. Unc was a well-made man, a light heavyweight, dark-skinned, with poet's lips, with soft brown eyes, in the shaded caves of a Cro-Magnon brow ridge. Incipient baldness had isolated a dramatic scalp lock. An illustrative anecdote about Unc. One time, when Unc's platoon was taking a shower, Henry Brackman, Unc's platoon sergeant, asked a sergeant from another regiment to pick out the best soldier in the platoon. The visiting sergeant, without any hesitation, picked Unc, because Unc was a compact, nicely muscled, intelligent man among boys. Brackman rolled his eyes.
"Jesus! You'd think so, wouldn't you?" he said. "That's the platoon fuck-up!"
"You kidding me?" said the visiting sergeant.
"Hell no, I ain't kidding you," said Brackman. "Look at him. Been standing there for 10 minutes, and he hasn't touched a piece of soap yet. Unc! Wake up, Unc!"
Unc shuddered, stopped dreaming under the tepid drizzle of the showerhead. He looked questioningly at Brackman, bleakly cooperative.
"Use some soap, Unc!" said Brackman. "For Christ's sakes, use some soap!"
Now, on the iron parade ground, Unc stood at attention in the hollow square like all the rest. In the middle of the hollow square was a stone post with iron rings fixed to it. Chains had been drawn rattling through the rings, had been drawn tight around a red-haired soldier standing against a post. The soldier was a clean soldier, but he was not a neat soldier, for all the badges and decorations had been stripped off his uniform. And he had no belt, no necktie, no snow-white puttees. Everybody else, including Unc, was all spiffed up. Everybody else looked very nice indeed. Something painful was going to happen to the man at the stake, something from which the man would want to escape very much, something from which he was not going to escape because of the chains. All of the soldiers were going to watch. The event was being given great importance. Even the man at the stake was standing at attention, being the best soldier he knew how to be, under the circumstances. Again, no audible or visible order was given, but the 10,000 soldiers executed the movement of parade rest as a man. So did the man at the stake. Then the soldiers relaxed in ranks, as though given the order at ease. Their obligations under this order were to relax, but to keep their feet in place and to keep silent. The soldiers were free to think a little now, and to look around, and to send messages with their eyes, if they had messages, and could find receivers. The man at the stake tugged against his chains, craned his neck to judge the height of the stake to which he was chained. It was as though he thought he might escape by use of the scientific method, if only he could find out how high the stake was, and what it was made of. The stake was 19 feet, 6 5/32 inches high, not counting the 12 feet, 2 1/8 inches of it embedded in the iron. The stake had a mean diameter of 2 feet, 5 11/32 inches, varying from this mean, however, by as much as 7 1/32 inches. The stake was composed of quartz, alakai, feldspar, mica, and traces of tourmaline and hornblende. For the information of the man at the stake, he was 142,346,911 miles from the sun, and help was not on its way. The red-haired man at the stake made no sound, because soldiers at ease were not permitted to make sounds. He sent a message with his eyes, however, to the effect that he would like to scream. He sent the message to anyone whose eyes would meet his. He was hoping to get the message to one person in particular, to his best friend, to Unk. He was looking for Unk. He couldn't find Unk's face. If he had found Unk's face, there wouldn't have been any blooming of recognition and pity on Unk's face. Unk had just come out of the base hospital, where he had been treated for mental illness, and Unk's mind was almost a blank. Unk didn't recognize his best friend at the stake. Unk didn't recognize anybody. Unk wouldn't have even known his own name was Unk, wouldn't even have known he was a soldier if they hadn't told him so when they discharged him from the hospital. He had gone straight from the hospital to the formation he was in now. At the hospital, they told him again and again and again that he was the best soldier in the best squad, in the best platoon, in the best company, in the best battalion, in the best regiment, in the best division, in the best army. Unk guessed that was something to be proud of. At the hospital, they told him he had been a pretty sick boy, but he was fully recovered now. That seemed like good news. At the hospital, they told him what his sergeant's name was, and what a sergeant was, and what all the symbols of ranks and grades and specialties were. They had blanked out so much of Unk's memory that they even had to teach him the foot movements and manual of arms all over again. At the hospital, they even had to explain to Unk what combat respiratory rations, or CRRs, or goofballs were. Had to tell him to take one every 6 hours or suffocate. These were oxygen pills that made up for the fact that there wasn't any oxygen in the Martian atmosphere. At the hospital, they even had to explain to Unk that there was a radio antenna under the crown of his skull, and that it would hurt him whenever he did something a good soldier wouldn't ever do. The antenna would also give him orders and furnish drum music to march to. They said that not just Unk, but everybody had